Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So Mike Obarto, chairman of the Board of Supervisors in Unity Township, Pennsylvania, I guess you got snubbed.
John, we most certainly did get snubbed.
Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama picked Unity, New Hampshire for their coming out party later today, not Unity Township, Pennsylvania. I mean, did they make a bad decision?
John, they made a very bad decision today.
I noticed that in Unity, New Hampshire, Clinton got 107 votes and Obama got 107 votes in the Democratic primary. You know, Mike, that doesn't sound like unity to me. What would you call that?
John, I agree with you. I would call that a split decision. And actually, I'd actually call it disunity.
Disunity. Disunity, New Hampshire. It's got a nice ring to it, Mike. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, June 27th. Adora Udoji is off today. The Democrats are testing unity in New Hampshire, but there's anything but unity in Zimbabwe today as voters go to the polls. A look at the reasoning, politics, and practical effects of a landmark Supreme Court decision on gun control yesterday. A roundup on Capitol Hill. Creativity grinds to a halt in Hollywood. Hint, it's not because it's Friday. That and all the news. Zimbabwe's one candidate runoff presidential election is today. The BBC spoke to an opposition party activist who says he's usually pretty tough since he's been abducted and almost killed by members of President Mugabe's ruling party before. But today he doesn't dare go to the polls.
I'm actually scared to move around as freely as I can. I still feel that they are watching me and they are following me. I'm scared to move around. I might be killed.
Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai's name is still on the ballot, but he's not in the race. He says the outcome will only reflect, quote, the fear of the people of Zimbabwe. Hillary Clinton campaigns for the first time with Barack Obama tonight in Unity, New Hampshire. Much to the chagrin of people in Unity Township, Pennsylvania, both candidates received 107 votes in the state's primary with just 1,500 residents. Locals say it's a big deal.
I think it's great for our town. Puts us on the map. Usually people don't know where Unity is. I've met a lot of people who go, you live where?
They'll know after tonight. Last night, Obama received a standing ovation in Washington from Clinton's biggest fundraisers when he said he'll help his former rival pay off her more than $20 million campaign debt. He's already written a personal check to her campaign for $4,600. It's raining in parts of Missouri, Illinois, and Iowa, already hit hard by the flooding from the Mississippi River. In Winfield, Missouri, everyone's taking a two-day break from filling sandbags. That's because they ran out of sand. They'll start again tomorrow. And this report just in, there appears to be a levee break in Missouri. More about that later. That's the news, at least some of the news, sketchily. How am I doing, Femi, okay?
Oh, you're doing great, John. I'm just going to add, of course, we'll be covering the Zimbabwe elections all the way through The Takeaway. I've just got off the phone to the Electoral Commission in South Africa. They have observers in Zimbabwe. I asked them what was unusual about this election. I said, just people aren't turning out. I said, give me an example. It's at 10 a.m. local time Zimbabwe. 40 people turned out so far to vote. Normally, you would have seen in a normal election hundreds of people.
So there's actually some question as to whether maybe we're giving this more significance by covering it. It's in the interest of Robert Mugabe, I suppose, to make this election a big deal. More on this all through the hour. Femi Okeh is with us. We want to hear from you, your stories about the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court strikes down gun control in Washington, D.C. What do you think? Call us at 877-8MYTAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. If you look at the Constitution and you look at the Second Amendment, it says two basic things. It talks about a well-regulated militia, and it talks about the right to bear arms. Well, the Supreme Court ended its term yesterday with a doozy about the Second Amendment, a 5-4 decision ruling that a ban on handguns in Washington, D.C. was unconstitutional and a violation of the Constitution, the Second Amendment's right to bear arms. The court struck down a D.C. gun control law. The ruling opens a new chapter in the handgun debate with legal challenges to existing handgun rules already happening. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. But joining us now to begin is Peter Nichols, the interim attorney general for the District of Columbia, where the ruling came down yesterday. And he joins us. Peter Nichols, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
First, let's talk about the reasoning of the court. They've essentially made a distinction in this 5-4 decision between controls on guns that would have an effect in the home and what might be controlled out on the streets of a city like Washington. How do you read this?
Well, I think what the Supreme Court said is that there's a basic right to self-defense in the home, and that D.C.'s gun ban law, handgun ban law, has to fail under its reading of the Second Amendment. This is a very unusual 5-4 decision because every court of appeals in the country before now, and the Supreme Court in a 1939 opinion basically said that the Second Amendment doesn't provide such a right. And so breaking with the historical precedent and attacking a law that's been on the D.C. books since 1976, the Supreme Court has made a decision that is going to have a very significant effect on the D.C. Regulation of handguns and I think, on violent crime in the city.
One of the perplexing things about the Second Amendment is it begins with the phrase a well-regulated militia that I referred to at the top of the hour and then talks about the Congress shall make no law to infringe the right to bear arms. It appears as though the court really just kind of ignored the well-regulated militia part and focused on the second part of the amendment. Is that your view?
That's right. There are a lot of words. There's about 170 pages of opinion. There's lots of study of history going back to the English Bill of Rights. But the majority of the court found that these words were clear, and they found they were clear by ignoring a lot of them. And that often happens.
Now, of course, you have a stake in this fight. You're going to have to implement what this decision means. What do you do this morning?
What I did this morning is start working with the police department on regulations that we're going to promulgate within 21 days because the mandate of the Supreme Court will come down to the lower courts in 21 days. An injunction will be issued at that time striking down the district's gun ban. And we've got to be ready to regulate the registration of handguns because the Supreme Court did nothing about that. We will have very strict regulation of who can get a handgun registered and what kind of handguns can be registered. And, of course, we're only talking about handguns in the home. We're not talking about allowing any kind of handguns on the street, in the schools, in the supermarket.
So people in the district shouldn't be concerned that, you know, everyone's going to have a gun in their trunk or their glove compartment. This really changes things in the home and at least initially is symbolic?
Well, I think it's quite symbolic in the sense that individuals who have wanted to have a gun in the home for protection are going to have that right if they qualify. And the reverberations from this opinion are going to be felt all around the country. I think the guns rights advocates will go after regulations in Chicago and San Francisco, a lot of other cities. So there's going to be a lot of legal turmoil. And I'm sure that as we proceed to regulate handguns under the Supreme Court's decision, there'll probably be even more litigation. Because one of the things I believe we can still do is we can ban the registration of automatics and semi-automatics, and we can require that handguns, which are lawfully registered in the home, can have some form of trigger lock to prevent kids and family members from being hurt by accidents in the home.
Peter Nichols, Interim Attorney General of Washington, D.C., thank you very much for explaining that Supreme Court decision yesterday, 5-4 on gun control in D.C.
we are concerned about, does this lead to everyone having a gun in our society? If they think that's the answer, then they're greatly mistaken. Then why don't we do away with the court system and go back to the old West, you have a gun and I have a gun, and we'll settle on the streets.
Powerful words from Chicago Mayor Richard Daley reacting yesterday to the Supreme Court decision. There's been a 6% rise in violent crime in Chicago for the first 4 months of this year. Tony Arnold covers criminal justice and politics for WBEZ Chicago Public Radio. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Attorney General Nichols was saying a moment ago from D.C. that this is going to reverberate in communities all around the country. I guess we could start with Chicago.
Yeah, it really, not minutes after the Supreme Court ruling came down yesterday, a lawsuit was already filed challenging Chicago's gun laws. People were basically waiting for this to happen.
And you actually talked to David Siegel, who was the plaintiff filing the first challenge. Let's hear what he had to say.
I'd like to see that ordinary citizens be trusted with the right to defend themselves and their families in their own home.
You spoke with David Siegel. Do you think there's an attempt to take advantage of this decision right here and ignore the sort of grim realities that have been materializing on the streets of Chicago over the past few months?
I think that there's no doubt that they're looking to take advantage of the Supreme Court's ruling. I think that they've been waiting and just waiting for this to happen. And they feel like this is their chance to get this law kind of stricken from the books. At the same time, the lawsuit's going to be a little bit different this time in relation to Chicago compared to the D.C. lawsuit. Mostly in that it's going to be a little bit of a different legal argument. There's now going to be talk of the 14th Amendment. Can states do this as opposed to municipalities or I'm sorry, the national laws? Since Chicago's is more of a the 14th Amendment's going to be coming into play in terms of the state rules.
Well, the issue is broader, Tony. I mean, we're talking about a states' rights question as opposed to a narrow version of whether this is an individual right or some sort of general right. But how does the self-defense issue affect law enforcement there in Chicago? I mean, the court on one level said very narrowly that any law that makes a weapon inside someone's home unable to defend them, like a trigger lock or forcing it to be put away somewhere where it really can't be used in self-defense, is unconstitutional. Does that really affect things on the streets of Chicago?
Well, I think it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to Mayor Daley, who's been this has been his issue for so long, one of his key issues is gun control, and I think that any more restrictions you can get to prevent the guns, he's going to say this is great. This is going to help save lives. At the same time, Chicago's seen more of a more violent streak recently, and violent crime has been up in the past year. And at this 20 the big news around Chicago for the past year is the number of public school students, young people who are being killed since September 27 around the city. Were killed earlier this week. There was an incident of an 8-year-old who was shot unintentionally while the police say that his parents were involved in gang activity, and a rival gang shot up the van, and the 8-year-old was the one who got the bullets.
Well, Tony, quickly, what regulations do the politicians in Chicago envision that might directly affect the availability of those guns for young people?
I guess I think what they're looking to get out of this is more of a way for less guns to be brought into the city. And really, I think what politicians are looking at out for in Chicago is more of a way for guns to just be less accessible. I think that they think if there are fewer guns in homes, there's going to be less accidents, less cause for them to actually just be used.
Well, the battle line's being drawn there in municipalities and communities around the country. Tony Arnold from WBEZ in Chicago, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
You've weighed in on the Second Amendment. Let's hear what you had to say.
My name is Bob. I'm from New Jersey. I'd just like to say I'm very happy about the Supreme Court decision yesterday. I've been a handgun owner legally for over 10 years. I've never abused the privilege, and I believe that ordinary citizens have the right to be protected.
More on the legal strategy, reasoning, and implications. There may be less than meets the eye in the Supreme Court decision later on in The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. My co-host, Adora Udoji, is off today. As Femi noted in the news a moment ago, Zimbabweans are voting today in the second round of a runoff presidential election where Robert Mugabe is now the only candidate. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai withdrew from the contest on Sunday. Mr. Mugabe has ignored calls from world leaders to postpone the poll, so what's going to happen here? It's very difficult to get reports on the scene. Journalists have been banned. Veteran journalist Andrew Meldrum lived in Zimbabwe for 23 years until he was banned, exiled in 2003. He's the author of Where We Have Hope, A Memoir of Zimbabwe. Andrew Meldrum, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Andrew is in our studios at WGBH Boston, Massachusetts. Andrew, just at the outset, put us in the mind of a voter in Zimbabwe headed to the polls. What are they facing? What must they be feeling? I mean, you were there for 23 years. I suspect on some level your heart is with these people this morning.
Oh, very much. And I remember Election Day in 2000 and 2002 and when people were queuing up. And at that point, Robert Mugabe was afraid of a popular vote. And so the police were actually turning people away from the polls. This time it's different. There's a very low turnout. And Robert Mugabe has made it clear by sending out his forces, the army, the police, and the war veterans, youth militia, and they have been beating and torturing and even murdering people across the countryside and in the cities for the past few weeks. And he's made it clear that he is looking for people to vote for him. And if there is a high vote for the opposition, then there will be a return to violence in whatever area there is a poll for the opposition.
Andrew, take a listen to this from one of our journalistic colleagues who's reporting from Zimbabwe. This is John Simpson of the BBC.
I've covered a lot of elections in my 40 years. I've never seen one as frightening as this. I've never seen one where you know that if you turn out, or if you fail, rather, to turn out to vote and you don't have that pink, indelible ink mark on your hand that means that you've voted, then you are liable to the most ferocious retribution from ZANU-PF.
BBC reporter John Simpson there. Andrew, he's essentially describing a situation where the populace is being coerced to vote for Mugabe, and he will use that tally as some sort of fig leaf to suggest that he has legitimacy.
Absolutely. People are being threatened to, threatened to vote and threatened to vote for Robert Mugabe. That's exactly what I was talking about. I've spoken to people in Zimbabwe, and they say that you have to have that ink on your hand to show that you voted, or else you could be, subject to violence from Mugabe's youth groups. And what we've seen is Mugabe saying, oh, yes, I'll speak to the opposition after the elections, after I win these rigged elections. And, of course, he'll be speaking, saying, well, I have the legitimacy of these elections, and therefore I'm the senior partner.
Do you think Morgan Tsvangirai and the MDC opposition have misplayed this in some sense by withdrawing?
Look, I think they're in a very difficult position. The violence, let's just go over it, in the past 3 weeks reached such a crescendo that more than 80 of Morgan Tsvangirai's supporters have been killed, including the wife of the mayor of Harare, who was dragged from her home with her 4-year-old son, and she was beaten to death. two other wives of MDC officials, as some other MDC, opposition officials were burnt to death in their homes in Harare. It's a frightening level of violence, and it's a level of violence that even South Africa, who has the President Thabo Mbeki has generally supported Robert Mugabe. Even Thabo Mbeki has had to acknowledge that this level of violence really makes the elections untenable.
Well, Andrew, acknowledgement is one thing, but steps to actually take some sort of action by the regional nations who have so much at stake down there is something else. There's been talk of peacekeepers and transitional governments, but what scenario could actually change things from the outside?
Well, you're right in focusing on the neighbors around Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe, rules in Zimbabwe, but he is affected by South Africa and by the other countries around South Africa, around Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola, Zambia. And those countries, they form a 14-nation bloc called the Southern African Development Community, and they are distancing themselves for the first time, really, from Robert Mugabe, saying already that the violence has made these elections flawed. And so if they say, if the regional powers around Zimbabwe say, no, these are not legitimate elections, and you, Robert Mugabe, are not the legitimately elected president, that's going to put Robert Mugabe for the first time as a pariah in Africa.
Andrew, quickly, we're used to thinking of Mugabe as a strong man. We're not used to thinking of Zimbabwe as a place like Beirut or Somalia filled with violence and lawlessness. What has the world lost in the Zimbabwe you knew?
The world has lost a country in southern Africa that was a stable, prosperous democracy that offered hope not only for all its own people, but used to offer hope to South Africa when it was ruled by apartheid and other places, that at that democracy, that a multi-party, multiracial democracy could flourish in Africa.
Andrew Meldrum, veteran journalist, lived in Zimbabwe for 23 years until he was exiled in 2003. He's the author of Where We Have Hope, a memoir of Zimbabwe. Thank you, Andrew. Now, oil is spiking, trading at a record well over $140 a barrel, and we have other headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. 28 minutes past the hour. Hillary Clinton campaigns with Barack Obama in Unity, New Hampshire tonight. Obama continues to ask his donors to help Clinton out of her more than $20 million campaign debt. Wildfires in California are threatening Big Sur. The Missouri community of Winfield has called a two-day break in its sandbagging efforts after they ran out of sand. They'll be back at it tomorrow, and they're still concerned the Mississippi will breach the levees. And this is the sound of North Korea dismantling its nuclear program. Now, it only took a few seconds, which is why I'm playing it for you a few times, but North Korea destroyed a water cooling tower at Yongbyon on live television this morning. The demolition is a symbol of the country's move to end its nuclear program. And finally,
ladies and gentlemen, Windows has left the building.
After 33 years, Bill Gates steps down from his full-time job at Microsoft.
The change we're announcing today is not a retirement. It's a reordering of my priorities.
Bill Gates says that he will stay on at Microsoft as chairman, but he plans to focus more on his charity work.
Poor guy. I hope he can find work. It's sometimes hard for people in retirement, to actually find productive work. Do you think Bill Gates will have any problem?
I think he'll have less time now than he used to have.
I see. Bill Gates. Yes, everyone, let's say a little prayer for Bill. Retiring today from Microsoft. How many billions is he worth?
A lot.
We wish Bill Gates well. Actually, he's supporting this program.
Are you jealous?
So I must be
Don't
nuts.
Be jealous.
I must be nuts for trashing Bill Gates.
Oh, now you remember.
Thank you,
Femi.
Yeah.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Yeah, hi, this is Dave Frisch, Staten Island, New York. The decision on guns by the Supreme Court illustrates the difference between judges deciding what's a good idea for the country and judges telling the truth. These judges could have agreed with everyone who believes guns should not be allowed, but they told the truth about the Constitution.
The Supreme Court has made it clear, or has it? Yesterday's 5-4 ruling was the first ever to directly address the Second Amendment's ambiguous text. For those of you who are constitutional scholars, a well-regulated militia, says the Second Amendment, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. What do you think about that? Weigh in like that caller did. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The decision left open the possibility that states may have some less restrictive laws that they could be permissible without violating the Constitution. Joining us is Sanford Levinson, professor of law and government at the University of Texas, Austin. He's the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It. Sanford, the court seems to say that there is an individual right to own guns. It's explicitly said that in this 5-4 decision. Do you agree?
Yes, I do.
And, you know, there are plenty of people who are saying that in communities around the country, this is, you know, something of a wake-up call to law enforcement that actually their ability to restrict guns on the street is less than they would like. But there are also a lot of legal scholars who are saying that this decision is nuanced and maybe is not going to have much of an effect. Where do you fall?
Much more with the latter, that what the case really is about, ultimately, is the right of peaceful, law-abiding people to have guns in their homes. So with regard to guns on the streets, I mean, one of the realities of the decision is that there's a lot of typical Scalia bluster, but at the end of the day, it's a really quite minimalist decision, focusing on the home and going out of its way to say that most federal gun regulations are perfectly all right. And so,
let's just remind people, Scalia bluster is not an aftershave. It's actually an indication that Justice Scalia, Antonin Scalia, was the one who wrote the majority opinion.
Exactly.
You know, what's really interesting here is that while he comes down very hard, apparently in favor of the Second Amendment, it is kind of narrow in this view about in-the-home self-defense. That's new, isn't it?
Well, it's new in the sense that the court really hasn't spoken at all about the Second Amendment since 1939, and the 1939 decision was a kind of five-page toss-off about the right of a criminal or the non-right of a criminal to have a sawed-off shotgun. So you can say that yesterday's decision is new, but I don't think that most people really were surprised by the result.
What do you make of the communities around the country who are taking political advantage of this, or at least the opportunity to talk about lawlessness in the streets? And I noticed that you've written on the Huffington Post this morning that if the court had gone the other way, it would have been, in essence, a campaign contribution to John McCain. Explain.
Well, I think that there's no doubt that the gun issue is one of the explanations for the rise of so-called Reagan Democrats, working class, largely white, largely rural, largely men, who really do like guns for a variety of reasons, including hunting, and I think properly believe that the Democratic Party for the last 20 years just hasn't been at all respectful of that point of view. And the Republican Party wrote out a huge welcome mat. And I think that if a decision by what would have been termed the liberals on the Supreme Court saying that, in essence, the state can take away your gun, I think that would have been a godsend for the McCain campaign and would have been an embarrassment for Senator Obama. Now, I think not surprisingly, Senator Obama has said that he basically supports the decision yesterday. And McCain, I think, will try to make some use of it by saying, well, it's only one vote. Only one vote stands between you and your gun. But I think it will be a much, much milder sort of campaign.
Well, it's interesting, Sanford Levinson. Thank you very much for joining us. It appears that the nuance of the case does make it less of a political opportunity than might have met the eye yesterday. Sanford Levinson, professor of law and government at the University of Texas at Austin. Now, headlines and more on the situation in Zimbabwe from Femi Oke.
Hello there, John. 22 minutes to the hour. Now, polls have been open for almost 8 hours in Zimbabwe. It's not an easy country to report from because there are international reporting restrictions. But here's the picture we've built up so far of how the elections are going. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai dropped out of the race because of violence, but he's still on the ballot, and technically people can still vote for him. Earlier on, President Robert Mugabe says that there's still room for Tsvangirai's opposition party in Zimbabwe.
Victory by us does not mean death, the death of the MDC.
Now, a BBC reporter who's working undercover has been touring some of the election areas.
Some of the people that I spoke to, particularly from Sunningdale, are telling me that ZANU-PF militias are moving door to door, forcing people to go and vote. They are threatening them with violence. One person said, told me that he'll be voting late in the afternoon out of fear of victimization.
And some of those early voters spoke to the BBC reporter in Zimbabwe.
It's my right to come and vote. So I would like just to vote, and then from there, just go to my house.
We as Zimbabweans need to decide the direction that we want our country to take. So we can only do that by voting.
We have come to vote for the president of this country. So that makes it very important to me.
I was just talking to Dennis Kadima. He's from the Electoral Institute of South Africa, and he covers elections all over Africa. He said what was specific about this election was that normally intimidation is very subtle for elections. But what's happening in this presidential runoff election is that intimidation, the violence, the threats, not very subtle at all.
You know, it strikes me that both with the image of the blowing up of the cooling tower in North Korea and with these really powerful sounds of voices from Zimbabwe, mm-hmm. I mean, both of these stories are potentially very propagandistic for the governments that are allowing this information out. I mean, this is a double-edged sword. We really want to follow what's going on in Zimbabwe and in North Korea, but these images also, it's really, really hard to interpret what
and
this means.
Could we possibly be encouraging
exactly.
those two regimes?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's certainly something to think about, but great job trying to give us a picture of what's going on the streets in Harare and throughout Zimbabwe. As Andrew Meldrum says, our hearts are with the people of Zimbabwe. Thank you, Femi.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Adore Udoji is off this morning. It's Friday, and of course, that means movies. And I want to introduce my colleague Sharon Waxman from Los Angeles. Sharon, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Sharon is a veteran journalist from all over the world, most recently of the New York Times, covering Hollywood and the entertainment industry, and now she's an L.A. blogger. Sharon, I wanted to invite you here to talk about the movies, and of course the biggest movie coming out is WALL-E. Is WALL-E big in your house?
WALL-E's going to be big in our house. I want to see it.
Well, the reviews from like Rotten Tomatoes are like 95%. It's getting 5 stars already, but there can be no wilder anticipation for a movie than WALL-E in my house, a movie about an environmental catastrophe on Earth and a little robot.
700 years into the future, mankind will leave our planet. Leaving Earth's cleanup in the hands of one incredible machine.
WALL-E. A movie with no actors and computer-generated dialogue. Wow, Hollywood's got to love that. It's a movie about robots, and it's just a natural.
Robots do cool stuff.
It's my six-year-old son, Zachary. Sharon, you hear him? I sat him and his twin sister, Regan, down yesterday and discovered that despite little exposure to TV and perhaps just a theater trailer, Disney has fully invaded their consciousness with WALL-E. I mean, I asked my two kids, what's the elevator pitch about this movie? And they actually had an answer. This is my daughter, Regan.
Basically, all he really wants is like a friend. And then he sees Eve and he's like, oh. And Eve doesn't really go like that. She just wants to be friends with WALL-E. But WALL-E sees that he's found a friend, which he's always wished.
Do you believe that?
Wow.
That is
market research, I got to tell you. That's fantastic. I know.
And, you know, they describe it as a relationship movie. It's about WALL-E and his friend Eve, and Eve is stronger and WALL-E is cuter. And you know, they actually told me that, you know, robot movies don't always work for kids. They don't go for just any robots. The characters, my six-year-old said, have to be believable.
Well, WALL-E is not one of those big robots that can stand up and sort of chase you. No? WALL-E is that cute kind of robot. And robots just, you know, have to be sort of funny and, yeah, sometimes scary.
Oh my God, I love that.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
You know, we don't do Terminator, my six-year-olds, but scary is good. But the part that really amazed me was this, Sharon. I call it the Disney effect, where anticipation for a movie becomes the deep longing for an object. In this case, a personal robot slave. Do you want a robot?
Yeah, sort of. Clean up stuff and organize. It'd be cool.
We all want a robot to clean up stuff and organize. But, you know, then it actually got worse when I continued this line of questioning.
It'd be cool to be one.
You want to be a robot?
I do.
My kids want to be robots. The world has ended. You know, 700 years in the future, robots rule the world. That's just fine to my six-year-olds. Disney has invaded their minds, Sharon.
Well, it's not just Disney, actually. It's Pixar. The thing about Pixar is very, very few things that people in Hollywood or companies in Hollywood have been able to do this. Disney has established a brand, but Pixar is its own brand. So
Sharon,
you know it's Pixar, your chances of it being a good movie are pretty darn good.
Sharon, stay with us. I want to talk about the impending Screen Actors Guild strike. Stay with us. We are the robots.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello, my name is Aaron Schlechter, and I feel that the Supreme Court decision regarding the DC handgun ban is an example of a highly activist court overturning well-established precedent from 1939.
What do you think of the Supreme Court decision yesterday on the Second Amendment? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Respond to anything on the program. For instance, what do you think about the movie WALL-E coming out in Hollywood? All eyes are on the Disney opening this weekend, but also on the Screen Actors Guild contract with studios, which expires on Monday. Plenty of talk about this being a repeat of the crippling 14-week writer's strike that ended in February. Hollywood strike, the sequel. Does it sound like that to you? Some observers say the industry is already in a de facto strike with rushed production wrap-ups ahead of next week. We have L.A. blogger Sharon Waxman on the line for the latest. Sharon, as you alluded to a moment ago, the, you know, WALL-E movie is going to be a really, really big movie, but it has, you know, no actors, and a lot of the dialogue is just computer-generated. It's kind of a metaphor. The actor-free movie is kind of a metaphor for this impending Screen Actors Guild work slowdown. What goes on in Hollywood in the hours leading up to something like this?
Well, there's a lot of breaths being held across town because, as your listeners probably remember, Hollywood just finished a strike a few months ago. That was the Writers Guild strike, and that shut down the industry for several months, and people lost jobs, people you know, were hit very hard all across the spectrum, not just the writers, obviously, but everybody involved in the making of movies, and that goes everywhere from the hair and makeup people to the dry cleaners to the restaurants. So what we're waiting to see, actually, is there going to be some kind of last-minute deal, or is the Screen Actors Guild going to agree to continue working without a contract? That's what's going on.
So I suspect there's some frenzied deals taking place as people try to get ink on paper before a work stoppage actually begins. Is there
I mean, you'd think there would be, but that would presume that both sides are really motivated to make a deal. But in this case, as in the last case, the studios are who are the producer side of this negotiation versus the labor side, which is, of course, the actors, are not so motivated.
Hmm. Is this about new media and futuristic kind of internet-related entertainment that we can't even imagine, or
yes.
is it about
exactly what's at stake? And that's what happened, of course, with the Writers Guild as well, which is that everything is shifting around in the media world in general, and it's shifting in Hollywood too. So the money that used to be made in huge measure by DVD sales is sort of, that's a mature market, and now there's all this money that is anticipated but has not yet appeared, that is presumed is going to be made in digital somehow downloads and in watching movies over the internet and all these kinds of changing ways that people are watching and consuming their entertainment. But nobody's quite figured out where the money is yet, but the guilds are afraid they're going to be cut out of that, like they already were cut out of the DVD stream in negotiations from decades past. So they want to avoid making that mistake again, but the studios don't feel any reason to give that to give quarter on that point.
Are there any actors who are stepping out here to try to be, kind of take one on the chin for the team and sort of fight the studios, or is everyone laying low?
Well, here's another problem, which is that the guilds themselves are not unified, and that is another reason why the guilds are the weaker partner in this. In the standoff, right now there are two actors guilds, John. There's SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, and there's the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, which is called AFTRA. That's about a quarter of the size or so of.
I'm a member of AFTRA. I need to disclose I'm a member of AFTRA.
Okay, thank you for telling us.
Not as an actor.
I'm going to tell you anyway the way it is.
Yeah.
They've struck their own deal, and so now there's a battle within the acting community of whether they should ratify that contract or whether they should stand in solidarity with SAG. So in other words, even among the actors, there's dissension right now over whether the right thing to do is to pull together and have united front against the producers, against the studios, or whether actors should go ahead and ratify their own contract and keep going.
It's complex. It's arcane. That's entertainment? No, I think not. It's just a potential work stoppage between the Screen Actors Guild contract, which expires on Monday. Sharon Waxman, thanks for joining us. Thanks for getting up this early to talk with us.
My pleasure. Okay.
LA blogger Sharon Waxman out in Los Angeles. We shift our gears now to the Senate, which is closing up business, but not because anyone's contract is running out. The word of the week on Capitol Hill seems to be punt. It's crunch time for Congress if they want to get anything done before they break for the 4th of July holiday. And joining us is Todd Zwillick, who's a reporter and host of the Power Breakfast from Capitol News Connection in Washington. Todd, what's going down to the wire here on Capitol Hill, and particularly in the Senate?
Hey, John, good to be with you. Well, the wire actually came late last night, believe it or not. They can pull a fast one on you. As slowly as the Senate moves, they can pull a fast one on you. So last night they sort of, I'll say, they limped across the finish line. They didn't exactly sprint, and they finished up a couple of things. The big thing that got done yesterday was the GI benefits for war veterans. This thing's been kicking around Congress for a couple of months. It was attached to an Iraq war supplemental bill to about $168 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, last night, the Senate didn't have to pass the actual war money. They've already done that. But this GI benefit was attached to that. It's $52 billion. It lets any serving veteran since 9/11 go to any college of their choice that they can get into, any state college of their choice for any amount of tuition, and government will pick up the tab.
And the president is expected to sign that bill. What about the FISA bill, the House, and the housing bill?
Yes, that goes under the punt column that you mentioned. You know, John, I heard your kids a minute ago saying they'd like a robot to come and clean up stuff and organize. After they're done at your house, send them to the Senate. They could really use a workhorse like that.
That's so, true. I could just send my 6-year-olds to the Senate. Maybe they could help even more.
It would actually probably be a help, I got to tell you. So here,
let's
here's
talk
what
about
happened.
FISA for a second. There was some bitterness yesterday. Here's Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold talking about the FISA bill.
Well, sadly, whenever this administration really stays on one of these post-9/11 international issues, the Democrats ultimately cave. And it's a sad record. It's not a proud record. It's something the Democrats should know better on. And as proud as I am of my Democratic leadership in general, they have dropped the ball on this, and so has any Democrat that votes for it. It's a very bad piece of legislation. Anyone who claims that it's been fixed doesn't understand it or hasn't read it.
He's talking about the reauthorization of the FISA courts for domestic surveillance of foreign individuals in the United States. What's going to happen?
What's going to happen is when they come back on July 8th, the Senate is already scheduled to take up FISA again, and they're going to vote on a Feingold amendment. Russ Feingold wants to offer an amendment to strip out the immunity provision. Now, you're going to hear a lot about that.
It's the immunity for telecommunications companies, right?
For phone companies that participated in the wiretapping program. He's going to have an amendment to strip that out of the bill so that they can't get immunity. That's what he's talking about when he's talking about the sellout of his leadership. What Russ Feingold managed to do was he can't stop it. This bill's going to pass, but he can delay it long enough. Look, everybody's going to spend, to the extent that they'll be talking about this over 4th of July, and who knows how much that really is. He's one guy. He has at least the power to have people talking about that over the break, and any desire to ram this through quickly did not happen. They're going to be dealing with that after the break.
Quickly on housing before we go.
Another punt. That was supposed to be the big piece of we're coming to save you legislation that was supposed to have passed this week.
$300 billion
in loan guarantees, and it was a bipartisan bill. That thing was supposed to grease itself up and glide, you know, right through the Senate. And the Senate is a little bit dysfunctional right now, John. And even bipartisan bills that are billed to have broad support and they're going to pass, there's always a holdup. And in this case, it was a bipartisan holdup. So they've got an agreement to deal with that bill when they come back too. So as soon as the Senate comes back, they're going to get back on the housing bill. I would love to tell you that it's going to glide through at that point. I don't think there's any guarantee of that right now.
And there's the veto at the end. Right,
yep.
Right. Veto threat. That'll kill it right off. Todd Zwillick, reporter and host of the Power Breakfast from Capital News Connection in Washington, D.C. Thank you. So not much good news for people with foreclosed houses barbecuing in their backyard for the 4th of July holidays. Keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. Send your stories to 877-8-MY-TAKE. We've been talking about the Supreme Court decision. Jennifer on our website said, I conditionally agree with the Supreme Court ruling that the individual has the right to bear arms conditionally because I don't believe all arms are equal. How about everyone has the right to bear arms that were available during the writing of the Second Amendment? Certainly those were not automatic rifles or machine guns. Maybe that would take the bite out of crime. Who would want to carry the powder, bullets, and wick of a musket? All right. It's movie time, so that means we want your movie reviews. Here's the mother of all trailers.
700 years into the future.
Like everybody else, I just keep waiting for a lotto ticket out of my boring existence.
But all that is about to change.
I know about your gambling problem.
You're insane.
He's extremely curious.
I really think you have me mixed up with somebody else.
And just a little bit lonely.
I don't kiss, I don't call you sweetheart or darling.
No, I'm looking for a girl.
I don't do three ways.
The movies WALL-E, Wanted, and Finding Amanda. If you have a review, call us with your quick take, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Have a good weekend.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,